Not only does he have an amazing eye, not only are his pictures evocative, accurate, creative, but he's also become a great friend and somebody I trust. It's been an extraordinary gift because I have the kind of chronicle of my girls growing up that very few people have.
President Obama speaking on CBS about photographer Pete Souza, the official White House photographer for 8 years. Today, we look back at some of our favorite interviews with artists, beginning with photographer Pete Souza. He has taken nearly 2 million photos of President Barack Obama, from when Obama was in the Situation Room the night bin Laden was killed, to meetings with world leaders, and to tender moments with Michelle, Sasha, and Malia. Now, Pete Souza is out with a photo book documenting Obama's historic presidency. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait, and it includes more than 300 images. We have a photo blog up on our website. If you want to check out some of the images, just go to curious.kcrw.org and type Pete Souza in the search panel. When I spoke with him last month, I asked Pete Souza how he winnowed it down from 2 million photos to the 300 that are in the book.
It was an agonizing process. I mean, I tried to create a narrative in this book to show what his presidency was like in those 8 years, but also give a glimpse of what he is like as a person, and then also include aesthetic pictures that give you a broad sweep of what it's like to be in the presidency. I think I did a good edit, but people are going to have to judge for themselves.
Now, you met him when he was sworn in as a senator, Illinois senator, back in 2005, and you were working for the Chicago Tribune. You were a photojournalist for the Chicago Tribune. So how did you make the transition from being a journalist to being White House photographer?
Well, I didn't approach things necessarily in a different way. I mean, I had a different employer, obviously, and it was on the government payroll. But, you know, the style of my photography and the way I approached any given situation didn't really change in the pictures I was taking.
The first two images of the book are images of Obama sitting behind a desk. The first desk is, he's on Capitol Hill. It's January 5th, 2005, when he's a senator, and it's in a really nondescript room. There are fluorescent lights overhead, no windows, a computer that's just been, you know, delivered. It appears it's on the floor. He's sitting behind a pretty bare desk with his feet up looking at papers. And then the second image is him on the phone looking at papers, sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. And it's a very different tableau. And yet he seems like he's doing the exact same thing. He could be reading the same papers. So what did you want to convey with these two images starting off the book?
Those are in my introduction. And I was trying to make the point of when I was photographing him as a senator, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, okay, someday this guy is going to be a national leader. He may even run for president. He may even be president. So I was consciously making pictures that might contrast with if he ever did become president.
And he says, he writes the foreword in your book, and he says that he spent more time with you than anyone else besides his family. And I guess you became very good friends with him.
I did become friends with him. When you spend that much time with any one person, you naturally become close. Sometimes we played cards together on Air Force One during long trips, things like that. And occasionally there'd be banter back and forth, maybe about, you know, last night's basketball game or something like that.
Well, did you ever see him unguarded, in the sense that I think the way that we have watched him, or we watched him for 8 years, is he seemed so deliberate, his words so carefully chosen, and even in unscripted moments, he seemed, well, I don't want to say buttoned up, but planned. Like he wouldn't say something entirely unexpected ever. Did you ever see a moment where he did act unexpectedly?
Well, I saw him unguarded all the time, but I think actually a lot of those unguarded moments are in my book. He had an acute sense of the words that he would say that could be made public, people paid attention to, that when the President of the United States speaks, it's important. It has repercussions in the country, in Congress, around the world, and I think he was always consciously aware of that.
And was he consciously aware that the photos you were taking were for history, for posterity? Was he self-conscious in that way? Or did he forget that you were there taking photos sometimes?
It's really interesting. I have this picture taken on January 5th, 2005. So the first day, his first day in the Senate. And he's eating a sandwich in his office. Sasha and Malia were them. And I'm probably 6 feet away. And it's this totally unguarded moment. And no one's paying attention to me. And even then, he was the kind of subject that the presence of the camera and the presence of me didn't bother him at all. He just kind of went about his business. I also have this intuitive sense how to blend into the background and not disturb, you know, what's going on. And I think he appreciated that. And I think that made it easier for him to have me around.
Did he ever say to you, don't take pictures of this?
I can't recall a time that he did.
Wow. So that's why you have 2 million photos. What is his favorite photo that you took?
Anything that has Sasha and Malia in it. You know, it was always funny. There's a picture in the book of, it's a staffer son dressed up like Spider-Man on Halloween, and he had come to visit the president. And as he was leaving, the president says, zap me one more time. And you see the president getting zapped by Spider-Man. And we used to hang these pictures on the walls of the West Wing, and we hung that one up. And he saw it when he walked down to the Situation Room and said, oh, that's like my favorite photo. And it was probably like, you know, 2 days later that he saw one with Sasha and Malia, and he's like, well, that's my favorite photo. So anytime he saw like a really nice photo of that included Sasha and Malia, that was always one of his favorites, and it kind of continually changed.
There's one of him hugging Malia in the living room with there's a Christmas tree in the background, and this was December 14th, 2012, the day of the shooting at Sandy Hook. What was going on in that moment?
Let me just set the scene a little bit. He had just, you know, 4 weeks before been elected to his second term in his presidency. And then this is the time of year when the White House takes on this aura of Christmas. It's just glorious. Decorations everywhere. This picture was taken in the private residence. You see their Christmas tree that they've already decorated. And he has come upstairs just a few hours after the shootings in Newtown to get his wife. They were going to go down and say a few remarks at this Christmas party downstairs. And it was the first time he had seen either Sasha or Malia since the shootings. And he was hugging her. And he really just didn't let her go. I think in times like this, he was not only reacting as president, but he was reacting as a parent and imagining what it must be like to be one of those Newtown parents where you've sent your first grader off to school, you know, which we all consider a safety zone, and then they never come home again because some crazy guy shot them to death.
Can you talk a little bit about the physical and mental toll of this job on you? You began this job when you were 54. What was it like for you? Because you must have been working all the time.
It was a great privilege to do this job. I'm honored that he chose me to do it. That's sort of the first thing I'd have to say. For me, additionally, it was just the 24/7 aspect of this job, where even if you weren't at the White House, you were always monitoring everything that was going on because you didn't know when you might have to come back in. So, you know, over time, that takes its toll on you, especially when we're talking about 8 years. So it's sort of the grind of the job, just the everyday grind that wears you down more than anything.
Hmm. Well, that was certainly the case when you took that iconic photo in the Situation Room the night bin Laden was killed. Can you talk about that, what it was like to be in that room?
Yeah, I mean, first I'll say that I'd been given notice that something was going to be taking place. So I was aware that I would have to be around on that Sunday. And we were at the White House all day. I mean, he had a series of meetings leading up to the raid itself, which happened like around 4 o'clock our time. So we kind of all piled into this small conference room within the Situation Room where the communications link had been set up to the guys on the ground in Pakistan. And they're all gathered around this little table. You know, you have the president, the vice president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of State, defense, representative from the CIA, John Brennan was there, Dennis McDonough was there, the chief of staff, Bill Daley, was there. So you've got the most powerful people in our government are all in that room at the same time. And unlike any other meeting, they could not affect the outcome because they had already made their decision to launch this raid in the days and weeks before. And now they're all gathered to see how it's going to play out with those guys on the ground. And it could have gone terribly wrong. And they were helpless to do anything about it. And I think that's what leads to this tension and anxiety on their faces. You know, most of the time when I was in the Situation Room, there was conversation going on the entire time, back and forth discussion. And in this 40 minutes that we were in that little room, there was very little conversation. There was just observation.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Pete Souza, former chief official White House photographer, about his new book of photographs, 300 photographs of his time at the White House. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Well, now you have a very healthy life on Instagram where you republish these photos, some of them, and you've been called out, I guess, I don't know, or praised in some quarters for trolling Donald Trump with these photos, so that when Trump does something that's controversial, you will print a photo of Obama doing the same thing, but it's a great photo. And I'm wondering about that. Did you set out intentionally to troll President Trump?
I had no grand strategy. It was more accidental than anything. I'm sure some people look at my Instagram feed and appreciate it, and some probably look at it and don't appreciate it. But I will say this. I think I've been subtle, respectful, playful, especially when you compare it to the comments that some people make on Twitter.
Some people meaning the president? Are you not going to answer that? I'll just leave it at that. Okay. I want to talk about the last day of the presidency where President Obama, you have a picture of him shaking hands with Donald Trump right after the inauguration ceremony. So what do you think of this photo? What did you capture in this photo?
This is symbolic of the transfer of power in our country. And I was thinking that, you know, my time was coming to an end. President Obama's time was coming to an end, and a new administration was coming in. And I look at that photograph now, and that's what it symbolizes.
Though the look on Obama's face looks pretty grim.
I don't know if he's grim. I mean, I think that
he's not smiling.
Obviously, he wished he had been shaking hands with Hillary Clinton. That's what we all thought was going to happen. You know, including possibly the person he's shaking hands with. But it didn't turn out that way. And I think he was trying to not say or do or act in any way that would be disrespectful to the incoming president.
Finally, I want to talk about one that I think you have said is one of your favorite photos that you took. And it's a picture of a little boy named Clark Reynolds. You don't even see the president. You just see his hand and his arm. And his hand is touching the boy's cheek as the boy is looking up at him. And the boy is what, 3 years old?
Yeah, he was 3.
Can you talk about that photo?
Yeah, this was at a reception in the East Room for African American History Month. And gosh, I probably had covered, I don't know, dozens of these similar type events in the 8 years. And it very seldom leads to a good photograph in that the president makes remarks from this little stage welcomes his guests, and then usually there's like a rope line set up, and he'll quickly shake hands with people along the rope line and then leave. And I saw this little kid standing at the front of the rope line. It's actually his necktie is hanging over the rope. And so I kind of had my eye on him when the president started shaking hands with people. And I was bent down right in front of him because I suspected the president would lean down and shake his hand too. And when the president came over for one brief second, he touched his face. Then the president bent down and looked Clark in the eyes and said hi to him, tried to straighten his tie a little bit. And I have that whole sequence. But that first picture before he bent down caught my attention, and I just felt that was the moment, not when he was eye to eye with the young boy. I tracked down, because I didn't know the name of the kid at the time, I tracked down the mom, made sure she was all right. We were going to make the photo public. And then I made a big print of it and had the president sign it to Clark. And he wrote something like, you know, dream big dreams, you will do great things in the world.
I don't know what it is about his hand right on Clark's cheek and the expression on the little boy's face as he's looking up at him. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of that iconic photo of JFK shaking hands with a young Bill Clinton, that you never know.
You never know.
You know, what's going to happen? That little boy might grow up to be a president.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be something. Well, Pete Souza, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on.
That's Pete Souza. He's former chief official White House photographer. His new book is called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Coming up, a show at the Skirball maps the murals of Los Angeles, sending photographer Ken Gonzalez Day on a quest to find and photograph hundreds of them. My interview with Ken Gonzalez Day next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Artist Ken Gonzalez Day spent 2 years driving around L.A. finding and photographing the city's most interesting walls. He documented hand-painted signs, street art, graffiti, and murals, images that tell us a lot about history, race, and identity in L.A. Those photographs, more than 140 of them, are currently on view at the Skirball Museum as part of PST LA LA. That's a collection of exhibitions and performances celebrating Latin American and Latino art in Southern California. And his show is called Surface Tension.
Many of us have very romantic or simplistic ideas about what we're seeing when we see an image on a wall. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to look at all of the city and to think of it as kind of a portrait of the city. I went to many different neighborhoods and took many different images. There are, of course, thousands that are not included in the show, and we'll have a site where people can upload their own images to the Instagram feed. We've created an interactive map in the sense that you can walk through the city, it'll be printed on the floor, and see where these are located. And then you might begin to think about questions like who lives where, which topics are appearing in which neighborhoods, and why.
Well, describe some murals that you came across that really struck you.
There are so many, but I think in the Limerick Park area, there's a wonderful mural that's sort of expansive and takes on the history of African-American life and certainly references the civil rights movement. And so when we think about communities trying to tell their story, this is one way that many communities have used. And of course, there are many early examples of Chicano muralism. And Judy Baca's The Great Wall, of course, is the largest mural in the world. It's in a park, and you can kind of go walk along and see vignettes of different moments from American life and California life in particular.
Well, I always think of murals as being aspirational or heraldic, telling a positive story about a group of people whose stories may or may not be told positively, or at least may or may not be told at all. And that murals are a way of kind of reclaiming one's own story.
Yes, they often are. But there's also, I think, another very large thread is memorials. And one in particular is the one that comes to mind is the one of Ezell Ford, who was a young African-American man who was shot by police in 2014. And that mural was created by the community to, you know, memorialize him. And there were many that I saw throughout many different neighborhoods that talk about sort of people that were lost. And they might be added to an existing mural. They might be tagged on top of. They might be created at the same time as. So I think it's also a way, if you don't have another way to express yourself or another place, it's a way of marking.
Right. So what is the difference between tagging, graffiti, and murals?
It's a wonderful question. And what's sort of fascinating about murals today is that in many cases, they actually might include all of those forms from the get-go. So the idea of tagging initially was just to sort of take ownership of a city in which you lived that you had no control over. And if you go back to the Chicano movement, they were meeting under the bridges and they were living a life that they felt was not recognized. And so the tag was a very small gesture as a way of marking a space.
And so where do you think murals are today? What is their main purpose?
I think the one thing I learned is that there's many different purposes. For many people, for example, in the Arts District, which is an area that's been very controversial in terms of displacing older residents or Latino residents, you might go to this new cafe. It might have the best latte you've ever had in your life. And there's a wonderful mural painted on the side of the wall. And you feel like you are part of the right side of the struggle, right? In the sense that it's reclaiming parts of the city that weren't being used. And it's bringing vitality and allowing creative voices. And that might all be true. But it's also linked to capital and to development of real estate and to rising rents throughout Los Angeles. And so it just points to other issues.
Well, I think what you're saying there, which is so interesting, is you're saying that the murals are used to signify a vibrant artistic community while that community is being decimated by development and rising rents because a lot of the artists can't afford to live there.
That's correct. And that's true in many cities. Some of the images in the show will look at homelessness. And there's also quite a number of really amazing, beautiful murals in sort of downtown Los Angeles around 5th and 6th, where many of the shelters are, that are actually might be very challenging to go visit, particularly if you were, you know, you couldn't necessarily take your kids there and go on a field trip. So the show is also trying to think about this whole idea of the surface tension is about the surface of the city, and think of the city as this place that has all these different needs and different desires and different failings and different challenges. And so it's not to say that there should be no development. Of course we should. But it's to look at the images openly and to think about what they're about, to try to figure out who painted them and why, and who's looking at them. Who are they for? It's a city that has literally, you know, tens of thousands of murals, and yet we don't really ever talk about it.
So, I mean, doesn't it sort of take the power away from what these murals are to have their representations inside a museum? I mean, it's about, as you just said, being in a certain community and being surrounded by that community and being in conversation with it that the artwork is expressing.
Right.
And when you take that away and put it inside, literally inside four walls, does that then change how one perceives it?
I'm sure that it does. And part of the idea is that, in my experience, most people in Los Angeles have not seen very many of the murals, and they don't go to very many neighborhoods. And so part of this was to give people at the Skirball, people in different neighborhoods, to see what the other neighborhoods are doing and see them all in one place. So we thought of it as not so much an exhibition about, you know, my photography per se, but about this idea of it's a portrait of the city done in many little images. And you might go there and you might say, you know what, I want to know more about that part of the city. I want to go see that section. And so we wanted it to be like a starting place.
When you're thinking about murals in Los Angeles, are they different than murals you would see in other cities, maybe in New York or in Rio or anywhere else? And if so, how are they different?
Yes, I think they are different because driving around the city for the past 2 years looking for these murals, there's so much about people's sort of relationship to the civil rights movement. There's so much about struggles, local struggles in the city, local struggles in the West. There's so much about African-American struggles and sort of, there's Filipino Town, there's a wonderful mural there. There's just so much about really American history and the American history that is that all of us, all the different cultures and communities, and each having some kind of image that they want to celebrate. And some of them are really, you know, lovingly taken care of and maintained. And many are repainted, they're tagged and repainted. And, you know, and so that some of these have been on the same building for 20 years or so and just constantly being nurtured and taken care of and maintained. So I think that level of these images sort of living in our city streets with us for such a long period of time and going unrecognized and unseen by us is worth slowing down, going a little bit out of our way, find that mural you're kind of curious about and just see how it feels to see it and see who's there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Surface Tension by Ken Gonzalez Day is part of Pacific Standard Time LA. It's on display now until February 25th at the Skirball. Coming up, Edgar Arsenault never wanted to make art about race, but his latest work deals with a black actor performing in blackface. My interview with LA artist Edgar Arsenault next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. More now of our favorite artists from our series Blank Slate. Let's listen back to my visit with conceptual artist Edgar Arsenault in his studio. It's a large garage space behind his home in Pasadena.
Hi.
How you doing?
How are you?
Good to see you again. Hey, how are you? Gina.
Hi. Gina.
All right. All right. So you guys got a real mobile operation here.
I know. This is
amazing. A dad and a microphone. And did you guys get a tour already?
No.
Arsenault grew up in South LA. He went to art school here, grad school at CalArts. He teaches at USC now and runs a nonprofit in Watts. Arsenault's work deals with history and identity through drawings, video, installation. He leads us to a back room where a dozen antique law books sit, marinating in vats of sugar water. He pulls one out.
Yeah, you can touch them there.
Wait, you're growing sugar crystals?
Yeah, that's how these get on here. They're grown. It's an organic process.
I guess sugar is organic.
Yeah, it's organic. So, you know, it's part of the, you know, what I call like the a kind of an embedded paradox when you think about crystals. Because, I mean, on one level, we think of them as being something which is frozen in time, right? But simultaneously, they actually grow organically like the roots of a tree.
The front of the book, where the pages are, is sealed shut with a thick bed of big white crystals. They're like literary geodes. The working title of the piece, The Crystal Paradox. The law books, the sugar. It's part of the larger question Arsenault has been exploring throughout his career as an artist.
When history comes into the present, what is it doing here now? And like, why does it resonate with us?
Those old law books, which once defined how people lived in our society, are now out of date. They're part of history. They are crystallized in time. Arsenault is interested in race and history and memory, which brings us to another project. It's a theater piece. It's called Until, Until, Until. And it's a reenactment of a performance at the 1981 inaugural ball for Ronald Reagan. Here's Johnny Carson introducing the original performance.
Ladies and gentlemen, as I'm sure you know, at the turn of the century, it was a segregated theater. And a black man, in order to appear at a white man's show, had to put on a black face so no one would know. And one of the giant stars of that era in the Ziegfeld was Burt Williams. And he kind of made fun of men's follies and foibles through his humor. And here tonight, to play tribute to Burt Williams, is Ben Vereen.
So he walks out, he's in blackface, you know, he's got on this kind of oversized, you know, brown suit and a brown top hat. And he's performing as Burt Williams, and he actually sings the song Waiting for the Robert E. Lee.
What's this out here? Why, it's the good ship Robert E. Lee, and it's coming!
And, you know, he's doing it in a kind of Bob Fosse, you know, high-kicking, happy hands kind of style, you know. And the performance is amazing, you know, it's incredible. And then once that ends, then the second act is where he, as Burt Williams, tries to get a drink from the bartender after the performance, in which he's denied access to that bar and told, essentially, you can't drink with us.
Bartender? excuse me. Bartender, yes, you, yeah.
set him up. No, sir, no, sir, that's quite all right, sir. I'll just go get small place sometime.
So, you know, him trying to hold on to his dignity, you know, he turns around and then goes back to the dressing room and then sings another song, which is so heartbreaking and so moving that, it brings many people to tears.
What is that song?
It's called Nobody by Burt Williams, which is one of his most popular tunes. And Burt was one of the most popular performers in America in the beginning of the 20th century, both black or white. You know, he was just kind of a superstar.
Why did he want to perform that Ben Vereen in front of Ronald and Nancy Reagan?
He said that he felt that they needed to see it. He had just finished performing as Chicken George in Roots. He had just come back from Africa with Alex Haley and a good portion of the cast from that show, and was convinced that America was ready to have a conversation around race. But he also knew that Ronald Reagan had a long history as a conservative, that he was a union buster. You know, he had a very public fight against the Black Panthers. So he thought that this was a way to get Ronald Reagan to shift his economic policies. That conversation,
by performing this performance?
By performing this performance, which you have to see it, which we recreate in my play. Now, the reason why I decided to make Until as a play was because of the way in which Ben Vereen's life after that event of him performing in 81 had, you know, mirrored in many ways, you know, what had happened to a lot of blackface performers later on in their lives.
Here's what went wrong. As Edgar explained earlier, there were two parts to Vereen's performance. The first part, where he performs in blackface as Burt Williams, and the second part, where, as Burt Williams, after his performance, Williams can't buy a drink in a bar because he's black. That second part wasn't shown on ABC, which was broadcasting the inauguration performances. So all people saw at home was Ben Vereen doing a minstrel show in blackface.
And he never got the opportunity to tell his side of the story because all of his friends, you know, they either abandoned him or they just stopped returning his phone calls, or they came out and spoke against him publicly. And, he got death threats, you know, people spit in his face when he's walking down the street. Some of the most horrible letters that you can imagine, saying you've set the race back, 100 years. You know, if you can imagine that. The question is, why am I telling the story now in 2015, 16, 17? I was at a birthday party, which I jokingly like to say, which I was not invited to. Who was sitting there but Ben Vereen. And I went over and I talked to him. You know, we sat down and we talked, and he said, I'll let you tell this story, but you just have to promise me that you won't allow that to happen to me again. And I said, I promise. And sort of with a deep breath, please, God, let this work out.
Do you think you, in a small way, rehabilitated his reputation by doing it?
Well, I can't take any credit for that. But what I can say is that I think that now is that time when people are receptive in the way in which they weren't, those 30 plus years ago.
So what is the relevance of that performance today for you?
Well, I'll say it like this. I decided to tell the story not from a historical perspective, but to tell it from the perspective of how Ben remembers it, which is as a series of traumas, you know. So there's that old mantra that goes, you know, everyone and everything in my dreams is me. So when the audience is watching Until, I'm placing them squarely within Ben Vereen's mind, right? So one scene kind of slips seamlessly into the other, and it jumps through time. You know, it starts in 81, it goes to 2015, it goes back to 81, it goes to 1890, and it kind of moves and slips in ways that it's hard to figure out exactly what's happening until the end, where you realize that the show is actually about you, the viewer, the audience, slowly starts to realize that the camera that's in the room, that's training around on the performer, is actually about them becoming aware of their perception of that history, and then them literally being in the same room, in the same frame, with that 10-minute performance, they actually see themselves projected on the walls and on the curtains, merged with that audience from 1981.
It's powerful. So you said to me earlier that you don't consider, you're not like overly concerned with race, like you don't always want to talk about race in your work. And yet this piece is all about that.
Yeah, I know, right? How did that happen? Yeah, it's funny, you know, I joke with myself because I, when I was in school, because I went to school here in Pasadena, I went to Art Center College of Design, and I remember promising myself that I would never do anything that dealt with blackface because I just felt like as a symbol, it was like a black hole of meaning. Like either you were against it or you were for it. It's sort of like it forced you to kind of have a moral judgment. It's like the same way in which somebody deals with a swastika or a burning cross or an image of Jesus or something. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't leave a lot of space for interpretation. So when I'm standing there with Ben Vereen at this museum, which I wasn't supposed to be in at this kid's birthday party, I'm thinking to myself, how did this happen? You know. And then when I'm directing a piece and a musical, which I don't like musicals, and here I am directing one, it just goes to show how funny life is. You know, you tell yourself you're not going to do something, and there you are square in the middle of doing it, you know. So, but, you know, actually the funny thing, is I think in many ways, like we, you know, artists create taboos and then we find ourselves attracted to the very thing that draws great discomfort towards us. And, you know, like James Baldwin said, you know, if you have a toothache, you need to pay attention to it, because if you don't, it's gonna kill you, right? And he was talking about the process of writing, that if you're, as a writer, you don't want to run away from the things that draw pain, but that you want to run directly towards them. And I was in a situation in which I could do that and then turn the audience's engagement with blackface into something that could be interpreted, that could be meaningful in a way in which they hadn't seen it before.
That was artist Edgar Arsenault. Coming up, more from our series Blank Slate with painter Larry Pittman, a fixture in the LA art scene for some 40 years. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Continuing now our revisit with some of our favorite artists who shape LA and who are shaped by LA. Painter Larry Pittman's work has shown at every major museum in LA. His paintings are in the Broad's permanent collection. He's on the board at MoCA and the Hammer, and he's been a tenured professor at UCLA since the late 90s. Curator and museum director Lisa Phillips says that Larry Pittman is one of the most important painters of his generation, because he bucked the minimalist trend before it was fashionable to do so. I met him at his studio earlier this year. It's a large white space tucked away in an unassuming office park in Glendale. It's cavernous, big enough to hold his massive 10-foot-wide paintings. And on a Friday afternoon, his studio is spotless.
I love the act of sweeping at the end of the day.
And are you very ordered about
the time you spend working and how you organize the actual working. Are you disciplined about your work?
Yes. If it's a mess, I can't.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I just can't.
Stressful.
Yeah, it's very stressful. And, you know, the world is a mess. So all I have here is my cell phone, which I love.
That's great.
That's it.
So you just cut yourself off from the world and create.
Yeah. And work, yeah.
Running vertically through the room is a large central table, about 40 feet long. On it are neatly organized canvases, pens, paintbrushes.
The table to me is like a big landscape, so it is always changing. You know, it's kind of laying out the tools of the trade.
Larry keeps a regular schedule. He arrives at the studio every day around 10, lays out his materials, and paints until evening.
I work on everything flat on a table. Even the really big paintings that you see here. So sometimes I actually crawl on top of them to be able to reach the center.
Wow. That's a lot of acrobatics.
Primitive, I think.
Color is a big part of Larry's work.
I love this paint. It's called Cartoon Color. It was actually originally developed for cell painting in animation, but it has a nice flat kind of velvety quality. And unlike, let's say, traditional acrylic, when it dries, it has an ever so slight sheen to it. And there's a nice absorbency to this paint that I particularly like. And also, it's tough as nails.
Well, you're not afraid of color, that's for sure.
No, I'm not colorphobic. Some people are.
Art critic Wayne Kostenbaum describes the colors Pittman uses as shades most painters would find too garish or kitschy for fine art. Peppermint pink, pine green, raincoat yellow, mulch brown. That color is in many ways a rebellion against classic modern painting with its sparse canvases, its simple lines, subtle shades of gray. And a lot of that radical taste comes from his training at CalArts in the 1970s. At that time, most art schools emphasized painters in the modernist tradition, painters such as Jackson Pollock or Robert Motherwell. But Larry Pittman was able to enter the feminist art program at CalArts, which taught a more radical approach.
Even though men were not really technically part of the feminist program, my partner at that time, who is now my husband, we met in graduate school, and we've been together for 43 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. But we were allowed to kind of orbit around it because we were seen as civilized. I think so. I think so. Yeah. You hit it on the head, Madeline.
Larry Pittman is not an easy painter. While some artists are minimalists, he is a maximalist. Every inch of his large canvases is covered in images. There are Visa credit cards, glittery shoes, bulging tree roots, large intestines. He uses imagery from science, comic books, advertising, and verses from American poetry. We go over to a large painting on the wall of his studio. Its colors are burnt orange, blood red, with accents of blue. There's a pair of dice on one side, a red female figure bent over on the bottom, a skeleton torso that looks like it's dancing, an electric guitar. He says it's a mix of two of his artistic heroes from the 19th century, Spanish painter Francisco Goya and American poet Emily Dickinson.
I always saw she was a mid-19th century, highly educated American woman who was clearly an atheist, a proto-feminist, and probably a lesbian.
Pittman identifies with her somewhat. He's also gay, a feminist, and an atheist, and not afraid of dark, disturbing themes or of confronting viewers with overtly sexual images. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that looks like a penis.
No, it's the end of an electric guitar. here's the electric guitar. That's the end of the electric guitar. I'm sorry, your mind is in the gutter. Or maybe not. It's actually traveling to another place.
Thank you. You cannot tell me I'm the first person to say that.
No, it happens. It happens.
So don't be afraid if you look at Larry Pittman's paintings and you just don't get it. You're not supposed to. He wants you to put away that logical, puzzle-solving part of your brain and really get lost in his work, in the colors, the shapes, the feeling of it. But there's also a particular element to his work that is specific to Southern California.
You grew up in Los Angeles. You went to school here, undergraduate and graduate. You have lived here your entire life, pretty much?
Yes, yes.
How do you think the city has influenced who you are as an artist? Where do you, when you look at your paintings and you look at your work and we go in there into your studio, where is Los Angeles in there?
I live in La Crescenta. Right now, as we're speaking, we're in Glendale. And then I commute to the west side to teach at UCLA. So that is a big triangle of driving. But if I can not take a freeway, I will. And sometimes I'll cross the whole city on surface streets because I love using that time to look.
Yeah, so you're saying the physical, the topography actually influences the character, the philosophical character.
When I've had many curators come to my studio over the many, many years, I started showing in Europe in the 80s. So I've had long relationships with European curators. But one of the things that they always comment on is they say, this work could have never come out of the East Coast. Your work, Larry, could have never come out of New York.
When you're done and you step away from your work, you think, what?
I've been very, very fortunate to make work that then gets exhibited. And I realize that that is a luxury, you know, that I know a lot of artists don't have. So really, for the last 40 years, from the very beginning of my career, I've always exhibited the work I've made. You know, in 2019, I'm having a 40-year retrospective at the Hammer. So I'll get to see 40 years of production. So,
oh my gosh, how do you feel about that?
I'm very excited. And in looking over the list, there's nothing I'm embarrassed about, which is good.
Larry Pittman is an artist and painter based here in Los Angeles, and you can see his work and the work of the other artists in our series at kcrw.com/blankslate. Well, I hope you enjoyed a re-listen to some of our favorite interviews with photographers and artists. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you next year.